You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
For the past 12 seasons, Mike and Mike have been bringing you a weekly look at all things geek, with reviews, discussions, interviews, and topicals from across the geekosphere. Now, with geek life slowly returning to normal in 2021, join the Earth Station One crew as we look at the return of the summer movie season, preview the fall TV lineup, look at all the big conventions now happening, along with other geek topics. You can listen to Earth Station One wherever fine podcasts are found, and as always, Earth Station One is a founding member of the ESO Network.
Hey, everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. Well, I'm going to do something again on this episode that I have done a few times in the last year or so, and that's to go back and revisit a movie that we had talked about before. Now, this is a film that Mark and I had talked about very early on in the history of Monster Attack. It was one of the first 10 films that we discussed when Monster Attack started, all the way back in 2016. And it's called Frankenstein Meets the Space Monster. And I wanted to go back and revisit this because if you've noticed, this season especially, I've gone and talked about films that I had a personal experience with, that I have a personal story attached to. Very similar to another Frankenstein movie that I talked about just a couple of weeks ago, with the late Veronica Carlson. In fact, that didn't really affect the fact that I was going to talk about this movie this episode, but I do want to take a quick time out, and she deserves so much more, but we had just found out that Veronica had passed away just a few days before I recorded this episode, and I would just like to send out my condolences to the family of Veronica, her daughter Carly, and her family, and those that I've gotten to know since I met Veronica a few years ago at the Monsterama Convention of 2014. I got to know her quite well, and we used to talk several times on the telephone. We had lost touch with each other these last few years. Her death still came as quite a surprise and a shock to all of us, who will miss not having a chance to possibly see her again at a future convention. So again, all of our condolences here from Monster Attack to the film of Veronica Carlson, and to all of her fans. Truly just a remarkable, remarkable lady, and one of my all-time favorite Hammer film women. She is number one on my list. Just a classy lady, just an incredible person inside and out, and I feel just very privileged to have had the chance to meet her and to call her friend. And she will be dearly, dearly missed. And I can honestly say, folks, without going over the top here, that the world is a better place for having known Veronica Carlson. And she will be missed. So we wanted to take time to do that because it came as just such a shock to us. And hopefully Mark and I will have a chance to get together and we will do a very special show that is dedicated to the memory of Veronica Carlson, who is truly one in a million. One in a million. Those of you that have met her, we'll know exactly what I'm talking about. Just a wonderful, wonderful lady. So back to another Frankenstein film. Well, Frankenstein Meets the Space Monster. In a little bit different category than Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed, which we talked about a couple of weeks ago. But these two films have a connection in my life because they centered around a time where a lot was happening to me, a major change in my life. And I'm talking about the move that my family made to Raleigh, North Carolina, while I was in high school. And, you know, I've already told you the story about, you know, how I really was finding my own in high school in upstate New York, in Auburn, New York, and where I was born and raised. And to make this move not only to an all-new school, an all-new city, but hundreds of miles away from the north into the south. So a big culture change. And of course, that first year that I lived in Raleigh, was filled with transitions. And of course, I didn't know what to do about my monsters, as I was telling you before. I had to make sure that I had access to monster movies and that sort of thing. I mean, I continued building monster models and all of that, but, there were no monster kids around that I knew. I was going to have to find all these people again. Well, as you know, I went to see Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed during that first year. It was one of the first films I saw in Raleigh, North Carolina, that was, a big movie, a big monster movie being released. But this film came earlier, Frankenstein Meets the Space Monster, because my family moved to Raleigh without me, as I explained, and I'll repeat this again. I had to stay in New York to take state exams. We had the Regents exams, and if I had left with my family when they did in May to move, then I would have lost the school year. I would have not gotten credit for it. So my sisters were young enough where they could transfer their credits in without any problems. But I had to have those Regents scores or I would have had to repeat the grade. So in order to do that, I lived with my aunt and uncle and my cousins for about a month until I got out of school in the end of June and then moved down to Raleigh just before the 4th of July. So the very first thing I did when I get to Raleigh, again, I know nobody in my neighborhood. I know nobody in the town. I don't know anything about the TV stations or anything. And this was important to me, that I had an access to monster movies. And, of course, I was scanning the TV guide all over the place because I didn't know what channels showed monster movies. I didn't know who to ask. And keep this in mind, folks. Of course, those of you my age will understand this. There was no internet. So it wasn't like I could just call it up online and find out who showed what. I had to wait for the TV guide to come out and just hope I could spot a monster movie and then maybe, figure it out. And that's what happened. I happened to be flipping through one of the TV guides. And all of a sudden, this movie shows up, Frankenstein Meets the Space Monster. And at first, I wasn't sure if I was seeing the right thing or not. I'd never heard of the movie. So I thought, well, okay. And it was on Saturday morning at about 6 o'clock. Now, I'm trying to remember this. Mark and I have mentioned this show several times during the run of Monster Attack. It's called Sunrise Theater. It was on Channel 5, WRAL-TV in Raleigh, North Carolina. And they would have and they may still have the show on. I'm not sure. I haven't been up there in years. But it would run very first, first thing before anybody got up in the morning. Everybody slept in late on Saturdays, but not me, because I was going to be watching monster movies. And the show either began at 6 o'clock or 6:30. I can't remember exactly. If any of you lived in Raleigh during that time, you can tell me what time it started. But it was before 7 o'clock. So I always beat my family up, as far as getting up in the morning so I could run down into the den, or actually just run around in the den. My bedroom was right next to the den, so I was in the downstairs part of the house. And I would get in there, turn on the TV, and plant myself there with a bowl of cereal and sometimes a cup of coffee, because I'd been drinking coffee since I was 11 years old. And, have a time of it, watching my monster movies. This was one of the first ones I saw on Sunrise Theater. One, I was really just very intrigued because this was a movie I'd never heard of. And I really had sort of prided myself. Now I had been around watching monster movies for a long time on the monster movie circuit, thought that I'd pretty much seen all the ones that had been shown on TV, and then to find one that I'd never seen, that was exciting. I just didn't really know if this was a real movie or not, and I couldn't wait to see it. And it was a real movie, made in 1965, and anything to do with outer space was something that always intrigued me anyway, because I was, as I've told you on many, many occasions, I was a huge, huge space fan. And, of all the astronauts and in all of the space missions. So I've always, always checked out sci-fis. But for Frankenstein to meet a monster from outer space, this just really, this had me going. And, of course, I wondered, was it really Frankenstein? Was it going to be a Frankenstein like I saw in Universal, or the Frankenstein we saw in Hammer Films, or whatever. And as it turns out, and again, folks, if you have not seen this movie, I'm going to spoil everything. So it's a great cult film. So if you want to see it first before you listen to the rest of the show, you might want to just put us on pause and go check it out. It's very easy to find. I think if you want to see it for free, it's available on Tubi. And I think if you don't mind, if you want to pay a couple of bucks, it's on Amazon Prime as well. So I've got a copy of it. I had to have a copy of it for my collection. I've had it for several years. This movie is something else. I got to tell you what. And as many of you know that have seen the movie now, it's not really Frankenstein. It's not the Frankenstein monster. Of course, you know, all of us monster kids knew that Frankenstein, that was the name of the doctor. That wasn't the name of the monster. But I was corrected on this a couple of years ago when it was brought to my attention. I found a couple of books to verify this, where the monster, you know, his name became Frankenstein somewhere around the time of the Son of Frankenstein, where it was legitimate, you know. So for the purists who said, no, it's the doctor, it's not the monster, he actually did become known as Frankenstein. That actually became his name. The townspeople or whatever, you know, named the monster after its creator. So anyway, so we don't have that fight during this show. But back then I thought, yeah, you know, it was not the Frankenstein monster that I knew. It wasn't even Dr. Frankenstein, you know, so. But it was a Frankenstein-like monster type thing, whatever. And we'll get into that when we talk a little bit more about the show. I had debated, folks, I got to be honest with you, I debated doing a Ragorama on this, and I decided against that, although this movie has probably been ragged on or riffed on or whatever, you know, over the years. But the fact that this movie warms my heart a little bit, because it made me feel at home in Raleigh, North Carolina. As strange as that sounds, this was my first connection to monster movies on TV. So I knew at this point that, you know, in spite of missing where I grew up and missing my old hometown and missing the high school that I went to and all my friends that I had virtually grown up with since I was, you know, like an infant, at least I had my monsters to watch on TV and my models to build. And so my life was going to have some semblance of normality in Raleigh, North Carolina. And I grew to love the city. I did in the years that I spent up there. I really did love that city. In fact, I'll be going up there for a class reunion in just a few months, and I'm very much looking forward to getting up there. I have not been in Raleigh in almost 10 years. So it's been a while. But so at this time, you know, I'm starting to feel a little at home. I still didn't know anybody, but I had my monsters every Saturday morning. And then later I found out that one of the other stations that I could get where I lived, the station out of Greensboro, North Carolina, had a nighttime Saturday night movie with Paul E. Bearer, if you remember him, a classic movie horror host who I believe was on some TV stations in Florida. Then he was in Greensboro, and he went to a couple of other places before he retired from the business. He was a wild guy, had these bug eyes and stuff like that. So, you know, by then, you know, I was feeling pretty good that I had access to monster movies. And then later on, this movie really became a memorable one for me when I was in college, when I was attending the University of North Carolina. Because just before my senior year, my roommate was going to be moving out at the end of the semester of the first semester of my senior year, because he was in the military and he was being called up for active duty. So I was in need of a roommate. And I was, you know, finishing out the first half of the semester, or the first semester, I should say, the fall semester. And I was, you know, Saturday night, I'm sitting in the lounge of my dormitory. Yeah, I know I should have been out dating. I know. I was a monster kid. And I'm watching the evening monster movie that came in on Channel 4, WFMY in Greensboro, North Carolina. And a guy comes into the dorm lounge, and he sees that I've got the TV on in there, and he's sort of a quiet guy, and he comes, he says, do you mind if I change the channel? And I said, well, yeah, actually I do, because I'm waiting for a movie that's going to start at 8:00. And he says, oh, you mean the monster movie? And I said, yeah. And he goes, oh no, that's what I wanted to watch. So we're the only two guys in there. And I go, oh, man, so you're into monster movies. Yeah. And I find out this guy's a monster kid like I am. So we warmed up to each other very, very quick. Yeah. His name was Joe. And Joe and I became roommates. Actually, you know, during this conversation, I said, hey, you know, I don't have a roommate for the next half of the semester. He didn't either. He was going through the same thing. You know, this was a time of life where there were a lot of kids that I went to school with that were in the military. We were still involved with Vietnam. And, so there were still kids, you know, having to serve in the reserves of the National Guard or whatever. So this happened quite a bit. So Joe and I ended up becoming roommates, the final semester of our senior year. But we met watching this monster movie, in the lounge. I don't remember what the movie was because we got talking about, I don't even think we actually watched it. It came on. It was in the background. We got talking about monsters. And again, see, this is how it was back then, folks. There weren't that many monster kids around. You know, we were a small number. It's not like it is now with the big horror fans and stuff. And now, you know, this horror and scary stuff is really cool. You know, we were the unusual, you know, sort of geeky guys, the nerdy guys who watch monster movies and things. We were going back and forth with the different monster movies that we loved and ones we had seen. And we made it sort of a little bit of a competition. We were going to see if there was a movie that one had seen that the other one had not. Because, you know, I explained to him, I said, you know, I grew up in upstate New York. That's where I saw most of my monster movies. And I've only been living, you know, in North Carolina now a couple of years. And so he thought maybe there might be some that he had seen that I hadn't seen. And we were going to make a little competition, see who was the first one who could stump the other guy with a monster movie they had seen. And to make, well, I'm making this story very long, but I should say, I won the competition because I had seen Frankenstein Meets the Space Monster. Joe must not have been watching Sunrise Theater that week because he said, I don't know if that's a real movie or not. And as it turned out, there were some other people that had worked themselves into the lounge. They got wrapped up in our conversation. They were also watching the monster movie. And the guy, one of the guys that was in there says, no, I've seen that movie. He probably saw it on Sunrise Theater like I had. He said, no, it's a real movie. Honest, I've seen it. So, you know, Joe had to admit. I says, oh, you saw one that I had not seen. So this movie has always been a very special movie for me. It always has. Now, I can't remember if I told that story back 6 years ago when Mark and I talked about the movie. I may have if I did and you heard it then. I apologize for repeating the story, but so this movie has always been sort of special to me. Let's talk a little bit about Frankenstein Meets the Space Monster. It's directed by a fellow by the name of Robert Gaffney. Now, a lot of the people we talk about in this movie, you're not going to know anything about. Robert Gaffney was a director. He was also a cinematographer and a producer. He shot four films. He produced five films, none of which I'd ever heard of. And he directed three films, one of which was Frankenstein Meets the Space Monster. The other two were short documentaries. He did a space movie right after this one, so maybe this was the stepping stone to a space movie called Bridge to Space, and he also did a documentary called An Answer. But he was on the camera and electrical department for 2001, A Space Odyssey. He did some of the second unit work on Lolita as well. So he worked on some big films. And in 2001, he didn't get a credit, but he was a director of photography for some small portions of the film. So the guy had been around some big films, so he was not a slouch. But this is going to be probably the highlight of his career as far as as a director. This is a movie we don't know much about. This was written from a story by a man by the name of R.H.W. Dillard. I don't know who he is. And George Garrett, who came up with the story, and also John Roundenack. Okay, got his name right. So, again, folks, we're not going to know any of these people. But they decided to get together and make this movie. And the movie was produced by Stanley Dare, Alan Iselin, who was the main producer on it, and Robert McCary. And they all decided, Robert McCarty. Sorry, Robert. They all decided to get together and come up with this movie. very little about, you know, I know very, very little about how they came up with it. Although years later, during an interview, Robert Gaffney was talking about his involvement. You know, he became sort of a cult figure because he directed Frankenstein Meets the Space Monster. And he said that, well, it was originally intended to be a comedy. And a lot of people took that, you know, say, oh, okay, oh, it was just a comedy. And it ended up, you know, being taken seriously by people or whatever, came this cult film, because nobody ever believed it would become this cult film. Now, folks, I'm going to conjecture on this. I don't believe that. Here's what I think happened during that interview. You know, and Robert, if I don't want to speak ill of the dead, but I don't think this was ever intended to be a comedy. The actors in here, you know, they played it straight. They played it very competently. The writing was not that horrible. Not really. The story's a little crazy, although the story is very similar to one that would, for a movie that would come out the next year called Mars Needs Women. If you remember, the one with Tommy Kirk, which is just an absolutely abysmal film. It's so bad that I don't even know if I'll do a rag-a-rama on it here on Monster Attack. It's just, oh my God. Anyway, we don't want to get into that. But so I mean, that film may have been influenced by this one, because this film is about the planet Mars. And it is suffered from an atomic war that has made the planet inhabitable. And it's killed all the women. And so you've got this small band of men and one woman, the Princess of Mars, who are on a quest to find breeding stock so they can repopulate the planet when it's able to be inhabited again. So they're not trying to take over the Earth, but they decided that the Earth could be, you know, is probably the best shot at them finding the proper breeding stock. Now one thing about this is they all speak English. There's no explanation as to why they speak English, because this is a low-budget film. So it's one of those things where it's like they didn't even care about explaining it or whatever. You know, usually, you know, there's a lot of films that I saw growing up where, you know, where they say, well, we monitored, you know, that these radio signals and TV signals that came out of the planet Earth. That's how we learned your language. They just speak English. They just speak it. You know, no matter what, no explanation necessary, which by the time I saw this movie, we just as kids accepted that, you know, we just, you know, that's just the way it was. You didn't have to explain it to us. We just, you know, suspended disbelief and just accepted it. But anyway, I'm getting off track here a little bit. I don't think this was shot as a comedy. I think what happened was that it became such a cult film. And Robert might have been a little embarrassed by the fact that he directed this movie. But then when it became popular, say, oh, yeah, yeah, well, you know, it was supposed to have been a comedy and, you know, it didn't turn out that way. And yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I think this turned out the way exactly that they were going to intend for it to turn out. And it was just goofy enough to attract a cult following. I don't think they intended to attract a cult following, because it's been my experience that if you try to make a cult film, you will fail miserably. You can't try to make one. You've just got to make the movie, and if it becomes a cult film, it becomes a cult film. And this one certainly became a cult film. It's got some great moments in it that we as kids really liked, and one in particular that was definitely influenced by another Martian cult film called Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. Now, you know, I think I may have mentioned this in one other episode, that Mom took me and my sister, my youngest sister, was not born yet. So when the film came out in the early 60s, she took us to the movie theaters one Christmas, you know, around Christmas time, when the film was released, and we you know, so I actually saw that movie in a movie theater. And one of the things that was the funniest thing in that movie to me as a kid at the time watching the movie was what they used for ray guns. Some of you know where I'm going to go with this. You know exactly where I'm going to go with this if you've seen both movies. There was a very popular toy that came out around the time of Santa Claus Conquers the Martians, made by Wham-O. These were the people that made Frisbees. Wham-O made this toy called the Air Blaster. You would pump it once and then pull the trigger, and it would shoot out this blast of air, and you could do all sorts of fun things with it. And that was what they used as the ray guns in Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. So they actually actually cocked it and pumped it like you would, and then popped the air, to shoot people and freeze them. Well, at least in this movie, they used the same thing. They used the Whammo air blasters. So it was like, when I saw this for the first time, I thought, oh my God, they're using the, and I hope they're not going to, you know, pump it up and do that like they did the other movie. Cause I immediately thought of, Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. They didn't do that. Luckily, they did some special effects where it shot out a ray. You know, they superimposed in a little ray light or whatever like that. And this was a disintegrator. So this was a very dangerous Whammo air blaster. So parents, I don't know if they still make that toy anymore. If they do, don't get the version that they used in Frankenstein Meets the Space Monster because it disintegrates people. Anyway, so that was one thing I really got a kick out of this. Okay, I want to talk some more about the people that are in this, and then we're going to get into a quick rundown. Yeah, I'm not saving a whole lot of time to talk about the storyline because the story is really fast. And the film is barely 70 minutes long, and it runs quickly. There are very few people you will recognize in this film, but one in particular that we will all recognize if we're into monster movies and horror films was James Karen. No, this was his very first movie. He'd done some television shows leading up to about 4 or 5 television appearances before he got this. But this was his feature film debut. He's done like over 200 movies in his career. And we lost him just a few years ago. But what a prolific career he had. But we'll always remember him as the boss of Craig T. Nelson in Poltergeist. And also one of my favorite cult films, and he went and did two of these in this franchise, Return of the Living Dead. He was a marvelous character actor, and he really found his legs. I think the Return of the Living Dead really launched him into, you know, so in the 80s, he really had quite a run with Poltergeist and several other appearances and made-for-TV films and big films, and he would show up all over the place, and he plays like the lead scientist in this who has created a robot, actually an android. I'm going to call it an android because it has human parts to it, that's going to go up into outer space and has a mishap on the space flight. And when he runs into these Martians who are, you know, getting ready to land on Earth to find women. To breed with their guys so they can repopulate the species. Now, another guy that you're going to recognize is Lou Cuttle, and he plays the lead Martian. Well, he's not the princess, but he's the lead Martian. Her right-hand man, and he plays Dr. Nadir. We don't know why he's a doctor, but he is in this. And he's a bald-headed guy that you'll recognize. Probably most people will remember him from Seinfeld. If you remember the episode where Kramer got the license tag that was supposed to go to a proctologist, I won't go, there may be kids listening, so I don't want to get into that show too much because they might not like the language. But Lou Cuttle played the proctologist who was trying to get the license plate back from Kramer. Or get the name that Kramer had on the license plate. But you'll remember the episode when I just, proctologist Seinfeld, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. That is probably Lou Cuttle also made several appearances on television. Lou had well over 100 appearances in film and television, all kinds of things. He was in all kinds of, you know, and he and James Walter, they're in big movies, small movies, TV shows, known every TV show known to man. And we lost Lou a few years ago also. He lived until 91. James Karen had a long life. I mean, so they had long, long careers in the entertainment industry. Lou was in the business for 40 years, 41 years, I think they said, when he passed away. So he started late. He was 50 years old when he got really going in the acting business. The other main characters you're going to see in this movie, Marilyn Harold, you might recognize. She started out as a legal secretary, believe it or not, and then she became an actress, and she was a showgirl. So she appeared on a lot of television shows as a showgirl, like George Gobel's TV show. Those of you old enough to remember that. She was a Playboy Playmate in 1959. She was the June 1959 Playboy Playmate. And then in just a few TV, she didn't do much in radio or in television and film. All of her credits amounted to 22 credits altogether, but she appeared in a lot of TV shows and would continue acting until 1970 when she appeared in a film, in an uncredited role in a film called Run, Jack, Run, which is, I'm sorry, it doesn't come to mind. But, I mean, she was in a lot of 60s and 50s television shows as well. And she plays our princess, our Martian princess. Again, all of the people in this are fairly competent actresses and actors. I mean, they do a really decent job. The other gal in the movie that you're going to see is Nancy Marshall. Oh, I should mention that Marilyn ended up getting out of the acting business and marrying a big, rich oil tycoon. So, you know, that she didn't need to act. She didn't need to work anymore. happened with a lot of showgirls back then. Nancy Marshall plays our ingenue, and she's the assistant to James Caron's character, who is Adam is his name. He's the main doctor who invents this robot that they're going to shoot into outer space. Everybody thinks it's a real astronaut, but it's a guy, he looks just like a human being. Nancy was in a few things. She had 18 credits, acted up until 1983. We know very, very little about her. She appeared in several TV shows. Richard Diamond, Private Detective, the David Janssen TV show that launched him and his career before he went on to do The Fugitive. Dr. Kildare, which was a big medical show. As a kid growing up, we all had to watch that. I think it was on Tuesday night. It was either on Tuesday or Wednesday nights. There was another big medical show that was out at the same time called Ben Casey also. But she was in one film. She played a school teacher in To Kill a Mockingbird. So she'd been in some, big movie. Hugely. In fact, she'd done that just before she did Frankenstein Meets the Space Monster. Again, know very little about her life. As far as her private life, all I've got is just that resume that I could pull up on her. But the one thing about Nancy Marshall and that might have got her cast in a sci-fi or a horror film is, and I noticed this the first time I ever watched this film, and just really marveled at it. She looks like a young Faith Demers, and of course Faith Demers was like one of my favorite female actresses. In all of the old horror films, especially all the old big bug films and things of that nature. And, of course, in This Island Earth, I loved her in that. And Nancy Marshall could be a dead ringer. She could be a younger sister for Faith Demers. She even sounds like her in the film. And, again, this is 1965. So, the female role in this, the ingenue role, she has sort of some romantic interest in Adam. Because she's his assistant and she sort of falls for him as well. Not only during this movie, you feel like there's a spark there all along. Her character's name is Karen Grant. The thing about her is that they really don't give her anything to do. she's just there. And she screams. She screams a lot, as women do in these monster movies. Like I said, this is a 65 movie. So she screams in a couple of key moments. She gets abducted by the Martians as well. So, a lot of let me go, please, don't hurt me. The helpless female type. And it's a shame because she's not a bad actress. She's a pretty good actress. And I would have liked to have seen her in more things. I wish I knew more about her story, but I know very little about her. Could find very, very little about her out there in the books and things like that. But so she and James Caron have a good chemistry together. I mean, they play this quite well, and of course, they end up together at the end of the movie. She also has a thing for Frank, who is the robot, and hence, a.k.a. Frankenstein. So what you've got, I mean, these are your main characters in here. There's one other guy that plays one of the big generals, the big general that oversees the space mission, and another guy that appeared in a few TV shows here and there. But again, I don't know a whole lot about his life. So you've got a lot of unknown actors appearing in this movie, but they do a pretty good job. And again, like I said, the script, it has some problems, but it's not as bad as you would think. And again, put the 1965 filter on and it's like, okay, it's passable. It really is. The storyline, somewhat passable, even though the aliens all speak English. You've got Robert Gaffney, who was a pilot in the military for many years. So he had access to all of this great stock footage. And this is where I'm going to compare this film a little bit to an Ed Wood film. But Robert does this really well. Ed had problems matching up all the stock footage he would use in his films to the real footage. Robert does a pretty good job on it. It actually is there's some big goofs and gaffes in this thing that you can overlook. But I mean, for the most part, he had access to a lot of great space stock footage. So you're going to see now, of course, I was a space nut. So when they show you the wrong kind of rocket and things like that, you know, I would pick up on that. But for most people, it sort of works. This is just before we get into the Apollo space program. So we're seeing what was then real state-of-the-art stuff. Because in 1965, we didn't know much about the Apollo program. We knew it was going to be the one. That's what everything was leading to, it so that we could go land on the moon. But as far as the rockets they used, we were used to seeing in 65, we're still watching the Atlas rockets launching the Geminis up there with the two-man crews. So we got footage in this film of a Saturn 1B. Now, the Saturn 1B is not the one that took us to the moon. That's the Saturn V. That was the monster rocket. But the Saturn 1B was about half the size, maybe a third of the size of the Saturn V. And that's the one, they only used it a couple of times. And one time just to put a capsule in orbit. And then it just went into orbit. It didn't have the other part, the service module. There we go. Sorry, I blanked on that. Part that they needed for the moon, because that's the one that had the LEM in it and all that stuff. You know, so it was just strictly the Apollo capsule. So it could be a lighter rocket. They just had to put it up into orbit. It was bigger than the Atlas because it had to handle three men and the extra weight of the Apollo capsule. So this was the first time I really saw one. Now, I had one in my collection. Remember a few weeks ago, I know I talked about this maybe during 2001 or whatever, where I had the model kit that NASA commissioned, and it had all of the rockets in it, from the Redstone all the way up to the Saturn V, in proportion. It was, again, one of my favorite models. So this is the first time I'd seen a Saturn V, you know, shooting up, because they basically just used it for test runs. Now, that was it. That it had a far different look than the Saturn V. So we have footage of that. So I was like, okay, well, that's pretty cool. So they got that sort of right. Although, you know, this was supposed to be a mission to Mars, the first manned mission to Mars. And something was going wrong with all the rockets. They kept blowing up. It's like something right out of the right stuff. And what was happening was we had this UFO circling around Earth, trying to decide, okay, we're still trying to, you know, figure this planet out. Is this the right one to go to get our women and all that stuff? And then they would see these rockets being launched, and they thought there were missiles being launched at them, so they would shoot them down. You know, the princess would say, shoot them down, so they shot them down. Well, they got this mission going on with Frank Saunders, and his great scene, one of the better scenes in this movie, where they're introducing Frank to the press, corps that had been following the space program, and during one of the questions, nobody knows who Frank is, and one of the old-time reporters says, you know, I've been around this program a long time, and I don't remember seeing you or hearing about you. How'd you get this mission? And Frank just sort of makes a joke of it and says, well, I guess I'm just the shy type. And he smiles. And it's an obvious freeze frame in the film. But it's like, and when I watched this, I said, what? They're just doing that for some sort of, you know, some sort of artistic effect or whatever. And then we realized, no, he's frozen. Oh, he's a robot. See, we don't know this. Even, you know, in the beginning, if you've never seen the movie, you don't know he's a robot. And they hustle him out and said, oh, he's tired. Frank's tired. Yeah, we got to get him ready for the mission tomorrow and all that stuff. And then I'll tell you what, the special effects, not bad, guys. This is a $60,000 film. They did, so, you know, they show, you know, Adam is, the cutting on this is very, very well done, the edits, so that it looks like he's pulling the scalp back of Frank. And you see diodes and transistors and stuff. And he goes, oh, the humidity in this thing is just screwing everything up. And I won't go into any technical things. He's going to coat it with some gel He said silicone gel, which would be the wrong thing to use. But, you know, he should have used something else. But we get into all that later. That's technical stuff we don't need for this movie. You know, and he fixes Frank. And so now we don't, oh, he's a robot. Anyway, they launch Frank the next morning for this long mission to Mars to find out if there's life on Mars, because they have picked up some signals from Mars. And they don't know if there's life out there or not. Of course, we found out that they're all gone because Dr. Nadir and the princess have told us that. And they think another missile's coming their way, so fire away. And they blow up that missile. Well, this is where they make sort of a goof. They blow the rocket up, and then they show it escaping. You know, I don't know if any of you remember the old space program where they got there's a little rocket that hooks to the capsule, and so in case they have an emergency, they can ignite it, and it'll pull the capsule away from the booster and then take it to safety and parachute it down. Well, they did that after the rocket blew up. So, you know, anyway, continuity problem, I guess, there. But anyway, Frank ends up landing in Puerto Rico. Wow. This is one thing that really impressed me about this film. On the budget they're on, they actually shot some location stuff in Puerto Rico. Amazing. Most of it was shot around Cocoa Beach in Florida. You'll see a lot of familiar sights from the right stuff in that. In fact, the motel where the astronauts would stay is the same motel they used in this one. So it was used by a lot of astronauts over the time. And the look at the Kennedy Space Center, it's amazing to see it. It's like you're in a part of Florida. It's like in the boondocks. There's nothing there. You know, I mean, it is not all grown up like the Space Center is now. So it's quite amazing. So it's a great nostalgia picture to look at as well. So they blow Frank out of the sky. And when he survives because he's a robot, and he gets shot by a ray gun when he encounters one of the spacemen who he ends up killing after he's shot, and his face is all burned on the left side. It just destroys the left side of his face. Hey, now we're getting into the Frankenstein stuff. Because when Adam and Karen are trying to figure out, okay, we got to find Frank. They know the capsule has landed in Puerto Rico, but they didn't find Frank. And she has the line where she said, where Adam says, gee, I wonder, he'd be totally out of control. You know, if the circuits are damaged, he could go on a rampage or whatever. I just can't imagine what it'd be like. And she goes, Frank could become a Frankenstein. Dun, dun, dun. Yeah, there you go. So that's the Frankenstein thing. Well, they fly to Puerto Rico. It's interesting. They change planes in the middle of the trip. They start out in a B-52. Yeah, I like planes too. In a B-52, and they land in like a C-137. That's all right. Picky. It's not in the little details, as Ed Wood would say. It's in the big details. And they find Frank. They do find him. He's hiding out in a cave. And of course, you've got Nadir and the gang. The princess has sent them on a mission to go get women. And there just happens to be a pool party going on, and they're able to kidnap like 8 women and get rid of that. By the way, Frank has killed a guy who was he's hanging out. He's having a picnic with his beautiful young wife. I either the wife or girlfriend or mistress. I don't know which one. She's playing around in the water, and then now we get to see all the women in bikinis, because that's what this movie's all about. Or that's something I wanted to put in this movie, as well as the music. I got to mention the music in a minute. They encounter 2 spacemen who disintegrate hubby. They kidnap the woman and haul her off. Frank, meanwhile, has killed some other guy that he's run into. Now that he's injured, he's going on a rampage, and the guy's chopping up coconuts, and unfortunately gets killed by the axe he was chopping the coconuts. So they find Frank in the cave. I know I'm going all over the map on this. I'm having fun. And they were able to calm him down. And Adam is able to fix him, but he sends Karen back to get help. He says, we got to have help with this thing. There's something going on here. You know, he was shot with some kind of a weapon or whatever. And, of course, you know, they don't know at the time the Martians are invading or whatever, but they find that out later. I'm going to really cut to the chase on this. I mean, one thing that I really enjoy, the only time the dialogue gets a little sappy is where Adam says, Karen, you've got to go. And she says, no, I really want to stay here with you. And he goes, no, you've got to go get the help. I've got to have that. You know, we can't make it without the help. And she just looks at him with these big doughy eyes. I remember me talking about Faith Demerge and the big doe eyes that would just melt someone. You know, oh, just all those big cat-like eyes that would just melt you. She has those, and then just goes, goodbye, Adam. It's heart-tugging. Anyway, while they while she's trying to get the help, she gets kidnapped by the Martians. By the way, there's a scene in the middle of this movie, between all of this, before they find Frank and everything, when they go look for Frank, that they go touring around Puerto Rico on a Vespa. Yes, I kid you not, on a Vespa. So if I was going to nominate this movie for worst use of a Vespa in a horror science fiction, it would be this movie. To the set to the tune of To Have and To Hold by the Distant Cousins, which was a two-man group that was handled by a guy named Bob Crewe, who actually handled some big stars in his time, like the Four Seasons. He actually did some work with Michael Jackson, Leslie Gore, and others. He was a big record producer. So they put two of his groups in there. There's another song that's in here while they're at the pool party. That's leading me to this. That was done by the Poets, which was another group that he did. So we've got some you know, basically 60s rock and roll that's thrown in here. It's totally out of place. Of course, in the abduction scene at the pool, we get to see a lot of women, a few of them in bikinis, and some of them in very tight capri pants, shaking their booty all over the place. Some poor guy who's swimming, and there's only like three people in the swimming pool, he gets up on the diving board and does a little dance to the music. Yeah, he's shaking his booty, turns around, there's spacemen. They go, oh, it's a man, we don't need him. Boom. And it gets vaporized. I'm sorry, shouldn't laugh. It's horrific. Anyway, Karen has been captured. Of course, the princess is like looking at all the women that they've captured. Yes, no, yes, no. And they're putting them in these cages, and Karen, they didn't like, because she had some kind of gizmo, the gizmo that controls Frank, that was too advanced for people of the Earth. And so she's put in the cage next to the space monster. Now we meet Mull, the space monster. Ah! And Frank ends up actually saving Karen so that Adam can go get the military to strike at the flying saucer. It's sort of not really a saucer. And it looks a little small for what they've got inside of it, but I won't get into that. Frank gets into a big fight with the space monster, so they don't meet. It should be Frankenstein fights the space monster. That would be a more accurate title. He meets him, and then they start clobbering each other while the spaceship takes off trying to get away from the military, but not in time for them to blow it up out of the sky. Actually, they don't blow it up out of the sky. Frank does. They try. They try bombing it, but they... It's like one of the worst missions ever for the U.S. Air Force. They couldn't hit anything. The missiles and the bombs are dropping all around the spaceship, but none of them actually hit it. So it takes off, and Frank actually, when he finally sort of, he shoots the space monster and then gets one of their ray guns, one of their Whammo air blaster ray guns, and blows the spaceship to smithereens. So that we see at the end, Karen seeing it all blow up, knowing that Frank is now gone. Because she had a thing for Frank. She really, I mean, she felt very close to him. She thought of him as a human being. Adam was more of the cold scientist type, but she and Adam get together, and she puts her head in his arms and just sobs because Frank is gone. And then we cut again to the song To Have and To Hold, and scenes of them riding on the Vespa all throughout in a very romantic sequence on this Vespa through... through downtown Puerto Rico, and a shot that I guess they had to keep in. It's on the end credits, so they figured, screw this. You know, the thing that you always hate if you're shooting a film on location is the passerby who doesn't know there's a movie being shot there. The guy who watches them go by and sees the camera and starts waving at it. Yeah, they left that shot in because it was like, hey, it's just the end credits. Just leave it. Just leave that idiot in there. He can say he got into a movie. This movie's a lot of fun, folks. It's well earned. It's cult status, and you know, like I said, it's got some special meaning to me because of the move to North Carolina and then winning the competition with my college roommate that year. So Frankenstein meets the space monster. As you can tell, maybe this came across as a little bit of a rag-a-rama. I don't want it to be, really, because I have fun watching. I've watched this movie twice in the last week, getting ready for the podcast, because I just have fun watching it. It's like an Ed Wood film. It's actually a cut above an Ed Wood film. And, you know, if it hadn't been on such a low budget, they might have actually been able to turn this into something. They were real close. I mean, obviously, the interior sets were made out of plywood, and that wasn't, they didn't shoot that in Florida or in Puerto Rico. That was shot on a soundstage up in Long Island, New York, Seneca Studios. So you know, they did quite a lot for what they had, for the money that they had, and the film returned them some money. And it did well on VHS, DVD. It was named as one of the worst films ever made on one DVD collection. I would never put it in a worst films category. I would not. It was enjoyable. It was fun. It was goofy. It was just a fun look at the way things were in 1965. Some fun space stuff. When we look at just how much we didn't know. As far as, you know, traveling to another planet and things. And I'm going to say, yeah, give it a shot. Just give it a shot and have some fun with it. Don't take it seriously and have fun. And that's what it's all about. And, you know, the best part about movies like this is that if you're feeling down and whatever, these kind of movies can at least get you in a good mood. And you can have some fun with it. And you can sort of, you know, we're going through so much crap right now in life. You can escape for 1 hour and 19 minutes in a movie like Frankenstein Meets the Space Monster. So there you have it, folks. I'm going to say go check this film out. Check it out on Tubi or on Amazon Prime and have a lot of fun with it. Folks, we'll be back with you again next week with an all-new episode of Monster Attack. Thanks for all the great support. Remember, we are now a member of the ESO Network. So check out all the great podcasts. They've got some great podcasts on that network. A lot of fun podcasts if you're into nerdy stuff, Doctor Who and other, you know, they've got Dragon Con reports now coming up if you're into Dragon Con and some of the conventions, and check it out. They really have some fun shows there on the ESO Network. Check it out, esonetwork.com. And of course, make sure to check out Monster Attack. Folks, have a great week and we'll see you next Monday.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
Join us weekly as we journey into DC's infinite frontier.
We discuss DC news, comics, television shows, movies, and more.
Earth Station DCU is part of the ESO Network. Check us out where fine podcasts are found.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.